Modern ideas about freedom are not setting people free. Catholics are debating what to do about it. R.R. Reno is next. Hello, and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. First Things is a big deal. It has had a huge effect on culture in recent decades, and it is one of the places that religious people go, and in some cases, non-religious people go, for thinking about the relationship of religion and public life. Its editor, its publisher nowadays is R.R. Reno. He's in the kind of standing on the shoulders of giants, I'm sure he would say. It was founded by Father Richard John Newhouse, a true giant. And one of the debates that's been going on within the pages of First Things and spilling from those pages out into the wider world, certainly out into the wider Catholic world, is a debate about modern ideas about liberty, modern liberalism, modern liberal democracy. These things are not producing what they promised they would produce: fuller and freer and more human lives. As a matter of fact, in many ways, they are enslaving larger and larger segments of the society. So what are we Catholics to do about it? Well, one way to think about it is that liberal democracy itself was, from its foundations, a failed idea. Another way of thinking about it is that liberal democracy was a good idea that got off the rails at a certain point, and we Catholics have the duty to get it back on the rails. Well, R.R. Reno was, and we'll call him Rusty in our conversation here, was in the office. And so we asked him about this debate that's going on within the pages of First Things and in the wider world. Here's what he had to say. Rusty Reno, editor of First Things, probably the world's most important publication on religion and public life.
I would like to think so.
I think so. Thank you very much for being here with us.
Great to be with you.
If you look at Catholicism from outside now, you see all the scandals, you see debates about liturgy and all that, and often that occupies us inside Catholicism. But there is actually a profound intellectual conversation going on in the Catholic world that I think is more robust in the Catholic world than it is anywhere else. And it has to do with liberal democracy and whether or not ultimately liberal democracy is humane or inhumane.
There's been an awareness, I think, as I recall, in the 1990s, or could even have been in the late 1980s, then Joseph Ratzinger wrote on Christian democracy and pluralism. And he, at that juncture, made the argument that, and it was part of what the founder of First Things, Richard John Newhouse, would say, that the best achievements of liberal democracy require the pre-liberal or non-liberal goods, especially the church and religious faith, in order to flourish. The so-called Birkenfelder paradox. Birkenfelder was a German political theorist who argued that paradoxically liberalism requires pre-liberal values or pre-liberal institutions in order to thrive.
But that argument does not mean, however, that any political system that a Christian society might produce will thrive because of the Christian underpinnings. There's something about the system itself that has a potency that it may require being plugged in to the energies of a Christian society, but it actually functions better plugged in than, say, a communism would, or a socialism, or a fascism would. Or maybe even the monarchy would. I don't know.
Well, there's that question about whether or not the modern liberal democracy is the best regime.
Yeah. That's where I want to get to. Yeah.
I think the church has always been agnostic with respect to political regimes. Mm-hmm. In other words, the church has functioned in empires and in city states. It's functioned in monarchies and in the modern era, in democracies. But that's a separate question. The church can have an opinion about which is the preferable regime without saying that the other ones are antithetical to the flourishing
Fair
of the Catholic
enough,
faith.
Yeah, right.
But I would say, with respect to, let's look back to the Christianity, the Christian faith, has a corrective effect on every regime. It helps correct its faults. And you can say that part of a aristocracy or monarchy is, you could say that the great vice is pride, that those who are in the high reaches of society can be haughty and look down with disdain upon those at the bottom. And obviously the Magnificat is a warning, and the Christian call to humility can correct the excesses of an aristocratic society. And Tocqueville worried that the democratic society had a very different sets of vices. Yeah. Mediocrity, also that equality can become very, the principle of equality can lead to a great deal of resentment of the inevitable differences between.
Yeah, any disparity is seen as injustice, yeah.
And but I think that liberalism is a project of freedom, removing barriers to one's ability to govern one's own life, and that Christianity also can correct the excesses of that, it seems to me.
Well, so the question that the way that the question is functions within the Catholic intellectual kind of firmament right now is essentially this thing that we have, this liberal democracy that we have, is it ultimately compatible with Catholic faith? Is it amenable to Catholic faith? And it seems to me one of the most important books of our century thus far is Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed. Mm-hmm. And so everyone in the Catholic world who has this conversation is, in a sense, having the conversation in response to that book, at least to some degree. I mean, it was that important, I think. But it seems to me that Deneen's proposition really is no. These things are not amenable to one another, and that he writes in your pages sometimes, and then some others who write in your pages, I'm thinking particularly of George Weigel, well, their tendency would be to say, yes, these things are amenable to one another. So resolve it for me.
Right. They're not compatible. In what sense? I mean, for St. Augustine, the city of God is antithetical to the city of man. And, you know, he's a complex thinker. But to some extent, for that matter, in the Gospel of John, the world, you know, whatever regime hates the witness of Christ. Or as St. Paul talks about our bondage to the principalities and powers that rule the world. So I would say that every political regime is in some sense antagonistic, if not antithetical, towards the true faith, because every worldly regime is tempted to see itself as the final and highest regime, so to speak, that its ends and purposes are ultimate. And because the state has a legitimate power to use lethal force, I think that's one of the definitions of the state. Is the state is that which has the legitimate power to inflict death upon its own citizens as punishment, or to throw them into battle, or what have you. And if we think that death is the final power, so to speak, or that it's the final reality, then it'll be very tempting to think that state has the ultimate. And of course, the church is utterly opposed to that notion. And so yeah, I would every regime, every political order is at odds, always potentially at odds with what the church teaches. But I find it hard to say, it seemed to me that Christianity has and still functions quite effectively in the American system, which is it may be imperfect democracy, but does seem to be a liberal democracy. So that seems to contradict Deneen's point. So Deneen would have to be making a more subtle point, which is that liberalism, as opposed to the liberal democratic society that we currently have, but liberalism as an ideology,
right?
If if allowed to sort of run rampant, will in fact lead to what is antithetical to Christianity. And I find that persuasive.
That's a very helpful ism. Distinction, yeah. The distinction between liberal democracy, which after all is just, this is how we're going to make decisions. We put it down on paper and then we make decisions that way.
Well, democracy is a majority rule, and liberal is that there's limits on what the majority can do.
Okay.
Right? So the majority cannot dispossess me, so I have a right of property. The majority cannot send me to a gulag and kill me. I have a right to life. Or the majority can't dissolve the family, that there's a natural right of right. the family. And so that's what basically the theorists of liberalism, people like John Locke, what they were trying to do is articulate the limits on government power, whereas democracy dictates who gets power. Liberalism dictates the limits on that power.
But the liberalism then as an ideology or as a way of life or as a set of maybe assumptions about what a human person is and what society is, that is a different animal. That's
yes.
a different thing.
Seems to me, right? Liberalism, its underlying truth is that as creatures born, as created in the image of God, we have the capacity for autonomy. And in other words, we have the capacity for self-command, that I have the capacity to govern my own life, and that it is more noble to live a self-governing life than it is to live a life under the dominion of others. And so that seems to be the kernel of truth in liberalism. That is true. I think the Christianity affirms that. Christianity, rejects any notion of forced conversion, for instance.
Right.
And so the most important thing about our eternal destiny is our decision for or against Christ. And that has to be one that we make and not others make, others are not making it for us. But then liberalism says, the question is, how can you be self-governing? That strikes me. Liberalism tends to assume that the great project is to remove the limits that are put on people's freedom to decide for themselves. And I think that if that's the project, eventually it becomes like an acid that actually undermines our capacity for freedom rather than enhancing it.
And that it seems to me that at least is in part, I mean, it's a very complex book, at least I found it somewhat difficult, Patrick Deneen's book, but the underlying idea is that liberalism isn't just about freedom, it's about self-determination as the defining quality of freedom, is that you say what your freedom is for and what it means for you to be free.
Yes.
And when you are a self-determining entity, then you're dangerous.
Well, I mean, the part of the thrust of the book is that as liberalism erodes the authoritative institutions, the non-liberal institutions, whether it's the authority of parents, the authority of teachers, religious authorities, the authority of moral norms throughout society, as it erodes these authorities, it claims to be empowering and liberating people. But I think Patrick's insight, and it's quite correct, is that we look around us and we see actually it throws people naked and powerless before corporate power
right.
or government power or Twitter mobs. I compare my childhood. I certainly grew up in a time, the old kind of bourgeois morality of the 1950s. I, kind of came of age in the 70s, and that still had some force. And to be odd or eccentric or, was painful. I mean, there was a strong emphasis on being normal.
Yes.
And so it was painful to be on the perimeter of the normal kids. But that pales in comparison, as I observe, to what high school students, especially girls, feel as their incredible vulnerability to being canceled on social media. So I ask, has our society become freer? Or are we in more bondage? I think we've become more liberal in terms of liberalism's removing of that constraint of normalcy, and that should have made people more free. But I think Deneen's insight is that, in fact, it has deracinated them and has deprived them of a context or a foundation on which to actually be independent of these social pressures and corporate pressures and economic pressures, psychological. I mean, gosh, the number of young people on medication for psychological problems is really what, it's like a third now.
Yeah.
This is not a sign of a society of Emersonian self-reliant individuals.
It sure doesn't seem it, no.
And so I think one reason Deneen's book really got a lot of traction is people, they do think, well, liberalism claims to be triumphant. And we're looking around thinking, but we don't feel very free. So what explains that? Yes. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that the book really resonated with people, many of whom, you know, I wouldn't put them in Deneen's own camp, but they nonetheless felt like they had to read it and think about it because they knew that they had a problem.
Yes, right. Okay, so this tendency in liberalism for the human being to be, as you said, deracinated, and that's a particularly strong word if you think of human nature as a social nature, and where even social media is more isolating than socializing.
That
you become the lone figure.
Paradoxically.
Facing the IRS or facing Walmart or Apple or whatever. And that's that is, in fact, inhumane. No, the way we live is inhumane. It was probably why we're so medicated. And if one-third are legally medicated, that's just the beginning of the problem.
Yes.
Because we're medicated in many, many other ways.
Obviously, you know, the heroin addiction epidemic and things like that are a kind of medication.
And pornography, for example, is medicating in a certain sense. It's providing a comfort and a context where otherwise, the self is just hurting.
So I guess you could say, look, freedom, liberalism is the ism of freedom. It's in the very label, liberty, that it promotes liberty. And so you could say liberty is being able to do what you want. And I think that's a non-controversial definition of freedom. Freedom is the ability to do what you want. And you know, part of the political discontent in America is that people don't feel that they are able to do what they want. What do they want? They want to own a home. They want financial security. So in an economic realm, they feel more, and Deneen speaks to this in his book, they feel more constrained and not empowered. If you look at polling, we have a big decline in marriage among Gen Zers and millennials.
Right. Yeah.
But there's not a decline in the number of people who say they want to be married. So we seem to have, people don't seem to be able to get what they want.
So
maybe they're in bondage to their own vices. It's not like somebody's got their thumb on them saying, no, you can't get married. In fact, on the contrary, Obergefell meant that men can get married to men and women can get married to men. There's been an expansion of the legal freedom to marry. More options. But as a social reality, I think people are not able to do what they want. And part of, I mean, this is the insight of the founders. They recognized that a democratic society required moral and religious foundations. And so that you have to have a disciplined populace in order to be able to exercise to be able to employ the right of self-government effectively. But this is actually, and I think that's been a long-term conservative intuition, so-called ordered liberty. But I think what Deneen is highlighting is that the triumph of liberalism and its aggressive erosion of non-liberal sources of authority have actually made people less free.
Indeed, yeah, and part of that, you know, I talked about human nature as social, but I had forgotten, but you just reminded me of it in something that you said, that Deneen also talks about our separation from actual nature, from the natural world,
yes,
because liberalism is an ideology of the domination of nature.
Right. It's a kind of rooted in, I'm not sure it requires it, but it's certainly intertwined with the Francis Bacon notion that the function of reason is to conquer nature and to use our scientific knowledge for the relief of man's estate, as it said. So we're always trying to manipulate and transform rather than honor and conform to nature. I think it's just related to this question of freedom. Aristotle, and I think it's a good Aristotelian insight, Aristotle recognized that, again, freedom is doing what you want. Let's keep with that definition. It's not Aristotle's definition, but we keep with that. It's very modern. But if we act against our nature, then we're going to meet resistance, so to speak. So we're kind of doomed to failure if our goal in life is something as contrary to our nature, because it's like friction, or it's like running uphill in sand, or whatever the metaphor you want to use to illustrate it. But it's just, whereas if we act, if our goals and ambitions and desires are in accord with nature, our nature, then we can operate smoothly and harmoniously, with much less friction. And so if what we want is in accord with our nature, we're way more likely to get what we want.
Yeah.
If what we want is discordant with our nature, we're almost doomed never to get what we want. And so this means that in a society that's conducive to freedom, young people have to be socialized and trained and disciplined to want what is in accord with their nature. And that was a kind of long-winded way of saying that, and liberalism, of course, rejects that anybody should have the authority to socialize others according to a determined end.
Oh, sense not even of parents what, should have that. I mean,
right.
Or least of all parents, right. Maybe so
there's
nowadays.
There's a kind of fear that if we have a clear view of what human nature is, that will be used to restrict the freedom of others.
Right.
And so that's what liberalism says. And I've become more and more, I mean, yes, it's always perilous to empower others to decide what human beings are for, but to refuse to accord to any that authority really does condemn young people to having to make it up on their own, which is I always told my students when I used to teach, if someone comes to you and asks you, what should I do? And you say, well, do whatever you think is best, is not good counsel. Oh, they wouldn't be coming to you if they knew what was best. Right. They want guidance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have an educational culture, a culture broadly in the United States today that that will not give young people, it will not tell young people what's best for them.
Yeah.
And it's really
kind of cruelty.
You decide what's best for yourself.
Right.
Well, this is a recipe for disaster.
Well, I said that as we have these conversations within the Catholic Church, I do think they're resonating through your journal. Certainly, you see non-Catholics interacting with this conversation. But I said that virtually everyone you talk to about these things, eventually Patrick Deneen's book will come up. But it does seem to me that there's at least the possibility that there's some way in which Patrick Deneen's book itself is a response to Richard John Neuhaus and George Weigel and some of the things that were done and said in the decades before Patrick Deneen's book came out, which I can't tell. I genuinely can't tell. Is there a difference in theory or in a difference in emphasis of what these various parties are saying? But there seems to me, at least to some degree, the emphasis of Richard John Neuhaus and George Weigel and some others is more positive about the founding of modern liberal democracies like the United States, more hopeful about that if we will just engender a recovery of our Christian heritage, and that the Patrick Deneen and now I think even maybe Scott Hahn and some others in that are less sanguine about that. Am I reading that correctly, first of all?
Yes, there's a question right. I think that's well put. But I guess I would try to, as I've tried to delve in this, some of these debates strike me as blind armies fighting at midnight. There's a lot of heat, not a lot of light. People talk past each other. So I've tried to think it through in my mind. I mean, someone like John Stuart Mill, classic liberal, 19th right. century. Mill, in his book on liberty, sees that, you know, the best society liberates folks from social convention so that we can undertake experiments in living. And so if you really believe Mill, then you would think it would be the duty of political authority to lend its power to the great task of undermining or even removing the authority of the social consensus over individuals. And this helps explain political correctness and so on, because it's obligatory. People say to me, I say that political correctness or the contemporary woke project is an attempt to eliminate any authority. It's a kind of anarchism with respect to the moral life. Well, say, how can you say that when they're so punitive? Well, my view is it's obligatory non-judgmentalism.
Oh, yeah.
You have to be non-judgmental towards others. You have to be. So it's paradoxical, right? There is...
Or some might even say self-contradictory.
I'm not sure it's because it's a okay. meta command.
Yeah, okay.
You know, thou yeah. shalt... There's a... During the 1968 student rebellions in Paris, and the most striking slogan scrawled on the walls with the... by the students was, it is forbidden to forbid.
To forbid, yes, I remember.
So that's a paradoxical statement.
Yeah, right.
It's forbidden to forbid. But it's a meta statement that there's one commandment, thou shalt not judge.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
And I think that's the reductio ad absurdum of John Stuart Mill's position on liberty. Mill's a complicated character, but let's just say that that's a certain way of taking Mill to the nth limit. There's a lot of that in our society now.
Yes, without question.
And it says that we should use the power of the state. So we have hate crimes, or you have anti-discrimination laws, and you get the florist or the baker in Colorado dragged into court because he won't bake a wedding cake for a gay couple. That's using the power of the state to punish someone for violating the first commandment, thou shalt not judge.
Judge, yeah.
So that's a kind of what I call liberal integralism, you know, which is yeah. that everybody has to fall under the authority of thou shalt not judge.
Right.
And that responsible civic authority will empower people to enforce that commandment.
Yeah.
I think Weigel Neuhaus thought that is, in fact, a dangerous tendency within liberal democratic culture. And that, therefore, our project should be to constantly renew and revive the non-liberal institutions of society.
Yes.
That church, again, university, family, local Masonic lodge, whatever it is, so-called mediating structures of society. And this will blunt the sort of jihad a character of liberalism unbound, mm-hmm. to use that image. And I think what Dineen and others are effectively saying is that sounds good in theory, but in fact, politics and culture are always intertwined, and that we need to have a politics that restores, uses political authority to restore the authority of family, church, civic life, and so forth, so that you know, the liberal integralist says everything needs to fall under to the thou shalt not judge, whereas Patrick Dineen is saying, well, we have to tip the scales in the other direction, and maybe not. There's no one singular rationale, but that. We need to use political authority in order to, you know, restore. I mean, it's a principle of subsidiarity.
Yes.
It's got two sides. Subsidiarity is that the higher power should not usurp the function of the lower power. But if you read Leo XIII on this, it also says that there are times when the higher authority has a responsibility to provide subvention or to provide support so that the lower authority can fulfill its function. And so effectively, child tax credits our principle of subsidiarity. The higher authority, the political authority, has a duty to provide the resources necessary for parents to exercise their legitimate authority over their own children. Or school choice or vouchers and all those kinds of things would fall under that kind of vision of subsidiarity. And so this is my point about, I think, a lot of heat, not light. I mean, would Newhouse, in fact, I know for a fact that he argued for school choice and vouchers and things like that.
Right.
Sabbath laws are another example of the use of political authority to support the work of church communities. So some of my pastor friends say that one of the big threats right now is the invasion of Sunday mornings by sports leagues,
yeah,
practices and games on Sundays mornings. And given America's, we Americans are kind of this complete maniacs for sports stuff, this can really erode the church's influence over young people. So again, I think this is part of one of Deneen's, to take Deneen's way of thinking and put it in practical terms. Well, should the city council establish what used to be called blue laws, Sabbath laws, that restrict sports leagues to Saturday and Sunday after 2?
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously this cannot be a violation of our constitutional order because we had these laws for 200 years.
Right, right.
But the last two generations has seen the recession of any kind of will to impose those. Lots of those laws were repealed. So I see Deneen in this kind of conflict turning on a certain kind of limited government skepticism, like, whoa, we start going down that route and the secularists are going to get hold of it and really use the power of the state even more to impose their view. Whereas I think Deneen's view is it's already, power of the state is already doing that, the singular commandment, thou shalt not judge. So we need to enter in and into this political debate and propose moderate but significant uses of political authority to buttress
those mediating
institutions. I'd say, I find myself siding with Deneen on that. I mean, the rhetoric, it can be overblown. You know, why liberalism failed. I don't think our constitutional system, I actually think it works actually pretty well. I mean, all the turmoil around the 2020 election, and you got to look back and think, you know, the founders, they weren't stupid guys. I mean, they kind of designed a system that's, it works really surprisingly well.
Yeah,
and so I have no interest in
seeing it as a thing of the past that it has in fact failed.
Yeah, I don't think
you see that its history is over.
No, what's the problem is that our ruling consensus has become overdetermined by a singular emphasis on liberalism. I think liberalism is really bad when it's a noun. Liberal is not good as a noun, but it's very good as an adjective. You know, a liberal democracy, a liberal Catholic. I would like to think that in some respects, I'm a liberal Catholic. You know, capacious with respect to those who disagree with me, willing to listen, even though I think a person is mistaken and wrong, according those who disagree with me, room in our society to live in the way that they think is right. I think these are qualities these are liberal qualities. But if I'm a liberal,
yes,
you know, if I turn it into a noun and make it, what am I loyal to? I'm loyal to liberalism. Then I become an activist trying to pass laws so that, you know, the Mormons can't socialize their children into whatever.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I'm
yeah, we're going to close Catholic schools in Oregon, as they tried to do.
Yes. So I think, again, why liberalism failed, that as an ism, liberalism does, it has a trajectory towards intolerance, it seems to me.
Right.
Because it's kind of monistic. Freedom is the only thing that we cherish when paradoxically we can't be free unless we cherish things other than freedom.
But how do you end up at a society that is not constantly over negotiating then over things that are really not negotiable, like killing children? Do you see what I'm saying? Like that if we're
Well, that's not, that is not negotiable. And I think, but the question of restrictions on commerce on Sunday, that is negotiable. I mean, in other words, there are people in Berkeley, California, who, it's a very secular place, but there may be liberals in Berkeley who worry about the invasion, the commerce's invasion of everything.
Sure.
And right. I certainly know Jewish allies who would like there to be a Sabbath, and given that it's a Christian nation that's going to be on Sunday, they would prefer that to the what we have right now. Yeah. Whether we have a Christmas creche in the city square, again, these are things we can negotiate about.
Yeah.
Whether or not high school seniors should be required to take a course in philosophy to graduate, that's up to negotiation. Whether or not they should have obligatory Bible class, biblical literacy, our constitutional system, separation of church and state, we can't have religious instruction, but the Bible is a
World literature.
It is basic, really basic world literature. It's a touchstone for Western civilization. And the idea that every high school student in America should have a working knowledge of some of the major books of the Bible strikes me as a perfectly sensible thing. You don't have to be Catholic or Christian to think that that's a good idea. So that's negotiable. I think that we could go down a long, long list of things where compromises can be made and agreements can be reached. Will they ever be finally settled? No. Welcome to political life.
Yeah.
T.S. Eliot said, no culture war is ever finally lost because no culture war is ever finally won.
Which is a terrifying thought, but also an invigorating
one.
Yeah,
but I think to your point about the question of life, I mean, you can't have a society where it's okay to kill innocent people.
No.
I mean, that's just not, or to enslave people.
Right.
So there are these intrinsically evil acts that are not open to compromise and negotiation. But we should never, never imagine that. The problem with liberals is that they have a tendency to define their own policy preferences as, you know, part of the tablet of the Ten Commandments, the new Ten Commandments, and they won't break any compromise, or at least they pretend not to.
Well, often I find myself reading these materials, some of which are in your publication, First Things, and thinking I'm not exactly sure what the distinctions are. I really appreciate your help in helping to make those clear distinctions.
I mean, the distinction between, I think, George Weigel and Patrick and other, Deneen maybe, but other so-called integralists, is that George certainly wants a renewal of non-pre-liberal institutions and authorities, but he wants it to be grassroots. The integralists say this is a naive view about the interaction of politics and culture, and there needs to be a political program for renewing these authorities. And this gives, you know, a certain kind of conservative the heebie-jeebies, because it means empowering the state to take action. But I think we can take state action. We do all the time with respect to everything and many, many things in our society. I mean, altering tax credits to try to promote marriage and family doesn't strike me as running the risk of coercion, which I think a liberal, maybe I'm a liberal integralist. Remember, liberal can be used as an adjective.
Yeah, right.
I probably am a liberal integralist in the sense that the argument that the liberalists make is every society has to have some vision of man's final end. And so a liberal neutrality is really the vision of a final end. Man's final end is to decide what his final end is.
Yeah, right.
Right? So it's this open-ended emptiness. And I think man's final end is to know and love God.
Yeah.
And if you believe that man's final end is to know and love God, then as a legislator, you of course are going to try to encourage the possibility that people will come to know and love God.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a liberal integralist, you have a lot of inbred suspicion of the power of government to achieve the ends that it proclaims to achieve. Right. So if we say our goal is to bring people to know and love God, and we use the power of government to do it, it's very easy for that to get co-opted by base motives. So you're very careful. And then secondly, you know, you can be a liberal by also, you know, that core notion that whatever we do to encourage, it should be an encouragement of people's encouragement of people's kind of free, affirmation of things. Every parent knows that, you know, every parent knows that you can't raise your children in the church and make them believe.
Yeah.
In fact, sometimes if you try too hard, it'll backfire.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So you can encourage, you can, to fail to bring your children to church is to guarantee almost that they won't. And we live in a liberal culture that does that. It says that it would be wrong. I mean, I know people, secular people who say that, though, do you take your children to church? Oh no, we want to give them the freedom to make up their own mind when they're adults.
Well,
but that guarantees that they won't.
Right.
So, so that, you know, these kinds of intuitions that we have about the limits of what authority can do will inform our sense of how to what extent we can use political authority to achieve good ends.
And it does seem that these Catholic thinkers are contributing to a wider discussion about the purposes of government, the purposes of economies and all of that. And it's one that your publication, First Things, founded by Richard John Neuhaus and the Journal of Religion and Public Life, is contributing to greatly. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks.
And congratulations on just the continued success of the magazine.
Thank you.
Just on a personal note, back in the late 90s, my dad bought me a subscription to First Things, and that subscription has never lapsed in the years since. It's meant a great deal to me, this journal, as it has to many other people. And it's not a journal where you agree with everything that is printed. It's a journal where you are provoked to think more deeply about what your assumptions were. And it's really a beautiful journal in that regard. In recent decades, I have really been struck by this debate, this ongoing debate, and its various dimensions about just how much can Christianity, in particular Catholic Christianity, be accommodated to the assumptions and the practices of the modern world, those assumptions and practices that are so often defended as almost being the end of history, as Francis Fukuyama said, but they're not the end of history. Liberal democracy is not the end of history. History goes on. There's more to debate, and there's better that we can do. So I'm very grateful that we got to have this conversation with Rusty Reno. Much thanks to all those people who put out this very fine journal, First Things. If you'd like to get in touch with us about this episode or any other episode, maybe a future episode you'd like us to do, shoot us an email, focus@catholic.com. If you're willing, please support us financially. It does take money to do what we do here. GiveCatholic.com is where you can support this conversation. If you're listening on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or one of the other podcast services, don't forget to like and subscribe so you'll be notified when new episodes are available. And we're growing on YouTube. We're very grateful for that. Particularly Zach is very grateful for that because his job kind of depends on that. So if you wouldn't mind subscribing and hitting that little bell down there, you'll be notified when new episodes are available and Zach can keep his job. I'm Cy Kellett. See you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.